Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, where we feature community conversations around South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel throughout our community and listen to local groups discuss what matters to them.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Ammon Swenson. April is National Poetry Month, and to celebrate that, we'll be meeting some renowned poets and hearing their work. Alaska Quarterly Review is a decades-old and highly regarded literary journal based here in the state, and these selections were pulled from their online video series, Pièces de Résistance. The programs feature writers reading and discussing their work in an intimate virtual setting. You can find those on the journal's YouTube page. Alaska Quarterly Review Editor-in-Chief Ronald Spatz speaks next.
Today, we're delighted to be featuring a poetry reading by poet W.J. Herbert. W.J. Herbert is the author of the poetry collection Dear Specimen, Beacon Press, 2021. It was selected by Kwame Dawes as the winner of the 2020 National Poetry Series and was awarded the 2022 Maine Literary Award for Poetry. The collection was featured in the New Yorker Climate Crisis newsletter and also included in Poetry for the Extinction Crisis on NPR's Living on Earth with host Steve Curwood. W.J. Herbert was also a winner of the 22 Arts and Letters Rumi Prize for Poetry, and Herbert's work has appeared in many literary venues, including Alaska Quarterly, The Atlantic, The Georgia Review, The Hudson Review, Southern Review, and in two volumes of The Best American Poetry. Library Journal said this of Dear Specimen: Herbert writes movingly about a world of extinction, using the lenses of fossils and storytelling to create an evolving worldview. The writer's gift for deep seeing elevates even the smallest details. In mostly short poems, Herbert describes a vibrant yet highly vulnerable world. She breathes life into the fossil skeletons and nature today, even our world in its current damaged state. A unique and thrilling collection that pulses with wonder, not to be missed. And poet Robert Wrigley, who's appeared in our pages and on this series, added, "There's no way to say this after reading Dear Specimen. I was stricken. I felt like my heart was breaking, because it was. But I also know this: if there is any consolation to be found in the acknowledgement of humanity's crimes against the planet, such consolation will come to us through art like that of W.J. Herbert. Yes, the book will break your heart because it is beautiful, eloquently, and artfully enacts our common responsibility in the loss of the thing we all share and depend upon, the single thing no one can leave without, our mother, Earth. It is my pleasure to welcome W.J. Herbert."
Thank you so much, Ron, for that lovely introduction and for inviting me to read today. I have a soft spot in my heart for Alaska Quarterly Review and for your 40 years of dedication. So thank you so much. And thank you, Danny, for facilitating this reading. I'd like to start with a poem that will be coming up in the Alaska Quarterly Review in the coming months. It's called When Knowing is the Same as Late Winter Waiting. Why is the body still working if it knows what's to come? Isn't it cowed? Sometimes I think the blood thinks, the way these robins must wonder whether the liquid amber will leaf again as they sit with their light bulb breasts glowing, orange suns among skeleton branches, clots in the deep vein tree. They flutter, as I imagine my heart does, just to see if it can feel itself alive in the quiet darkness of stiff ribs. Regreening, that's what the robins want, but they can't know what's coming. They wait as we do, death's tucked into a pocket of sky. Well, as Ron mentioned, my first collection was Dear Specimen, and it focused on a speaker's whose impending death was difficult, and she was looking for answers for how to put her life in context, and she looked at specimens in a museum, and she looked at the animals around her, and she tried to understand what her death would mean also to her daughter, the daughter she would leave behind, and to the planet, the dying planet that she was, what our future might be with the climate crisis. And it, as soon as I finished that book, I began writing a second collection, which I'm a manuscript I've just finished. And it too has a grieving speaker, but this speaker is grieving for her own mother's death. And she's trying to come to terms with it. And she and her mother, when she was a child, her mother brought her to the desert, the western edge of the Sonoran Desert, where they discovered the flora and fauna of that rich desert ecology. They had come from the Midwest. And her mother especially loved the desert bighorn sheep. They're called Peninsular Desert Bighorn. And these sheep have been endangered since 1970. And the Desert Bighorn Institute has done a captive and breeding and release program. So the herd is very, very small. In 2000, it was the San Jacinto herd was only 4 ewes, which is a functionally extinct herd. So this poem takes place at the moment of her mother's death, but she's thinking back on the childhood and their mutual love of the sheep. In the poem, I mentioned creosote, not the mixture of noxious chemicals we use to protect wood with, but the native plant that grows on the rocky hillsides in the desert. And I also mentioned ocotillo, which most of the year you see only as spiny skeletal branches attached to the sand. But when it rains, little green leaves bloom. And in the spring, there are fuchsia blossoms, so which hummingbirds love. Precipice. The endangered peninsular bighorn inhabits canyons, washes, and cliffs. That's the epigraph. Precipice. After the herd slipped into the hills above the gashed plateau that builders carved from a cliffside scrap of habitat, seekers who came to breathe sage, creosote bursting open after rain, would peer from terraces, searching the dry hillside for camouflaged rams. Bellies bulging, ewes could barely cobble a path to water deep in the canyon, newly cut by a winding road that trucks hurtled up, churning dust, scarring blind curves with a halo of danger. After a lamb was struck, the herd tried to move on, but there was nowhere for them to go. We didn't see them die, but saw the signs. She went that way too. I watched a hummingbird lap nectar with a silken thread, its frantic fans cooling an ocotillo branch. I ate lunch. Her eyes were closed when I told her that I'd nap there at the foot of her bed. I was asleep when she stopped breathing. So the manuscript circles back again and again to the moment of her mother's death, but each time the reader returns, you know more about what their life together was like, how they experienced the desert together, and their love of the desert. And this poem, you can see that the poem itself disappears on the page, and it sort of mirrors the kind of loss that we feel when a loved one dies. In the vacuum left by her last breath, I tried to hold on to her bedpost, but had no hands, and so spiraled up fraying, as if I were a fantasy depiction of the cosmos, stars constellating from a core so cold, you know it's not real. Below, she lay motionless, arms freckled plump as if still soft. Her nightgown, the green of honey mesquite, whose seeds sparrows love. If I hadn't become the Milky Way, I would have touched her. You can see in the background, I'm doing this reading from a very beautiful space. It's the University of Arizona Poetry Center, a center that was started in 1960 and which now has 60,000 volumes and documents, including a rare book room, broadsides, chapbooks. It's a truly remarkable place. And I'm at the anteroom to their rare book room. Back behind me is a sculpture by a Hopi woman called Look to the Mesa. And so I come as often as I can, once a year, to read everything that I can get my hands on and to really enjoy poetry in this beautiful, well-lit space. And speaking of light, I wanted to tell you a little bit more about this manuscript, which I'm not giving you the name to just in case the title morphs, but at the moment, it goes in and out, as I said, of the moment of the mother's death. But because the daughter has, at one point in her life, told her mother that she wouldn't go with her to see the sacred spaces of Saint-Chapelle in Paris and the Chartres Cathedral, she feels some guilt. This was at a time when her own mother's mother had died, and the mother seemed so inconsolable that the speaker of this manuscript, Sarah, decides not to go with her. It's going to be too much grief for her to hold. But when her mother dies, she finds herself in looking at the stained glass windows, trying to understand what this loss could mean and how somehow in the sacred light through the windows, she might find some relief from her grief. This visit that she makes to the cathedral and the chapel is interspersed in the poems that are the memoir of the desert. So what I'm going to read to you is a small segment from this larger canvas of the stained glass windows, the Baroque stained glass windows. And in this particular section of it, it's told from the first person of Sarah. She's narrating it. And all you need to know is that in Chartres, there is a Baroque sculpture, massive, 250 tons, called the Assumption of the Virgin, and it dominates the high altar at Chartres. A priest casts over his head, then mine, mist from a holy implement, but the organ's chords clash, their dissonance a dispute over the existence of eternity, light in a dome of sky, the choir singing to a dozen elders wearing overcoats because the cathedral is so cold, the little bells announcing what? A man in a trench coat speaking French into a microphone, his syllables so elongated that echoes obscure his words. Then the call and response are, no, it's just another hymn. While a boy nesting in his mother's arms, head buried in her sweater, begins to wiggle. Has anyone told him who the whale-sized figure carved in marble is meant to be? Shipwrecked stone, its waves rolling beneath a floating body whose arms beckon. The woman trying to rise from her tomb's cloud ship. Angels shouldering the ethereal white and billowing stone of her body, as if lifting easily the impossible rock. Its marble lit with incandescence, as welling up in waves, the voice of the choir laps against it, their hymn its own cloak. And I can feel my cheeks heat, the air of the cathedral taking on a green tint, lichen's tinge seeping into the priest's cassock, his assistant's robes no longer white but jade-like, the lectern mossy, even the smoke swirling out of the censer is emerald, but the glass of the Gothic windows glow with the same disturbing red as yesterday when the light was stingier, and I wonder why these greens have descended like a second eyelid. as if I were a serpent coiled in a choir stall, biding its time. The priest intoning ad infinitum his vowels, a river of ragged stones thrown from the microphone as if he could drive the doubt out of me. But I know what it means to be cold. My mother's skin is unflinching as marble, no more likely to rise than bubbles trapped in glass.
That was poet W.J. Herbert. Alaska Quarterly Review Editor-in-Chief Ronald Spatz speaks next.
Today, we are featuring a poetry reading by poet George Bilguer. George is the author of 9 collections of poems: The Going, University of Missouri Press; Big Bong, Copper Beach Press; The Good Kiss, University of Akron Press; Haywire, University State University Press; The White Museum, Autumn House Press; Imperial, University of Pittsburgh Press; Lead Pages, Pittsburgh Press; Central Air, Pittsburgh Press; and most recently, Cheap Motels of My Youth, Rattle Poetry. George came into national prominence in 2002 when then U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins chose his collection of poems, The Good Kiss, to win the University of Akron Poetry Prize. Collins then named George to one of 2 Whitner Bittner Fellows for 2002 and invited him to read at the Library of Congress. In 2006, Ed Field chose his book Haywire to win the prestigious Mae Swenson Poetry Award, and radio host Garrison Keillor began reading George's poems on his daily national radio program, Writer's Almanac. The popularity of George's poems on the show led to his appearance on Keillor's long-running NPR radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. George's many honors include the 2022 Reader's Choice Award for the Rattle Magazine and the 2021 Editor's Choice Award for the New Ohio Review. He has received grants and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Ohio Arts Council, the Pushcart Foundation, the Fulbright Foundation, the Whitner Bittner Foundation, through the Library of Congress. In addition to Alaska Quarterly Review, his poems have appeared in Poetry, Kenyon Review, Best American Poetry, New Ohio Review, Field, Georgia Review, Southern Review, Suwannee Review, Plowshares, and the New England Review. Of his poetry, Alicia Ostreicher said this: George Bilguer is an absolute whiz at the twists and turns of the glorious American language, the flexible American syntax, as spoken by everyone up and down the great chain of Americanness in our bewitched century. Oh, what a pleasure to watch. It is my pleasure to welcome George.
Ron, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. What a pleasure to be here. And I would like to thank the Alaska Quarterly Review and the Anchorage Museum for hosting me on the show, and for Ron Spatz for introducing me and putting this whole thing together. It's a delight to be part of your series, Ron. and I thought I would begin my reading tonight by reading the poem that I guess kind of brought me to Ron's attention and had brought me into the Alaska Quarterly Review. It was a poem I wrote a couple of years ago. My wife and I were at a local cafe here in Cleveland, where I'm from. And it was a beautiful Saturday morning. And I was sitting there sipping my coffee, and this couple came in. And there was something about them. They were an older couple, really, around my age. There was something about them that was so striking that I couldn't stop watching them. And I didn't really know what it was as I looked at them. But as, you know, listeners out there who are poets know, these things get into your mind and you start working on them and you realize, I've got to write about this. So I wrote a poem about this couple who showed up in the cafe that day, a beautiful summer day in Cleveland a couple of years ago. And the poem is called Arrival. I've seen that couple before. Mid-70s, I'd say, trim and gray, arrived here from a good life, They give off that we know what we're doing vibe, that sense of a fine journey behind them, full of kids and grandkids, dinner parties on the patio, summers in the south of France, and some very skillful navigation through all kinds of weather that got them here safely. A little fly-blown, it must be said, but that's the 70s for you. One day, he said to her, "There's this nice little cafe. Good coffee. The toasted bagel with cream cheese is outstanding. It's about half a century from here. Why don't we go there together? And I'll read the Times, and you can kind of gaze off dreamily at the people passing by with your fabulous dreamy gaze, now and then taking a sip of your cappuccino." "Okay," she said. And 50 years later, there they were, sitting next to us there. And I hope I'll see them this summer as well. I have a new book out. It's called Cheap Motels of My Youth. And I thought I would begin the reading today by reading a few poems from this book. It's from Rattle Press. And the opening poem in the book is called Nine, as in age nine. I happen to be the world's oldest relatively new dad. I have an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old. And observing the 11-year-old when he was, a couple of years ago, when he was nine, you know, I mean, one of the reasons we have kids is to relive our own childhoods, right? I mean, the delight in watching them go through the same things that we went through allows us to be kids again for their whole childhood. So watching Michael going about the business of being a 9-year-old inspired this memory of mine from being nine years old, many, many years ago. It's called Nine. I'm standing by the pop machine at the gas station, drinking a root beer. It cost a dime, my whole allowance. My bike, a J.C. Higgins 3-speed, looks cool. I just washed it and waxed the blue fenders. Grown-ups are moving around me in kind of a fog. Actually, I feel sorry for grown-ups with their neckties, their dark jackets, and serious talk. I am wearing low-top Keds. Their shoes are hard and gigantic. Try climbing a tree in those shoes. How am I supposed to know that an old, white-haired guy, a grown-up, is watching me from his desk in the future, writing down every move I make? Why would anybody even do that? If there's one thing I don't like, it's writing. Writing and division. This root beer is actually excellent. It's a hot day. My fenders are waxed. And that was a glimpse into my mind when I was 9 years old. Another poem from this collection. One of the pleasures of watching children is seeing their sense of time. They have a very different sense of time from the grown-up adult sense of time. Time is very flexible. It's very plastic. It barely exists in their minds. And this poem called Avocados, written a few years ago when my son Michael was 5, this poem speaks to that difference between grown-up time sense and kid time sense. It's called Avocados. My son comes into the kitchen and asks if he can have an avocado. Avocado, he says, loving the weight of each green syllable on his tongue. Avocados represent an immense step for him, an evolutionary leap far beyond the narrow confines of cornflakes, wherein he has dwelt for so long. The breast, the cornflake, the avocado. Such has been his journey thus far. "You'll have to wait until they're ripe," I tell him. "You want some cornflakes instead?" "No, thanks," he says, and wanders back into the world of being five, while I'm doing the dishes at this point. I start thinking about ripening and how glad I am that it takes time, and his own ripening will be years in the making. "Years," I say aloud, enjoying that long, luxurious syllable like a cat stretching out on my tongue. As Michael comes in again, it's been 5 minutes, and asks, "Are they ripe yet?" "No, not quite yet, honey. Want some cornflakes in the meantime?" "That's okay," he says. "I'll wait."
That was poet George Bill Gare. Alaska Quarterly Review Editor-in-Chief Ronald Spatz speaks next.
Today, we are delighted to feature poet and writer Cheryl McCallum. From Jamaica and born to a Jamaica father and Venezuelan mother, Cheryl McCallum is the author of 7 books of poetry published in the United States and the United Kingdom, including Behold, which is forthcoming from Alice James Books in 2026. Her other collections include No Ruined Stone, Alice James Books, 2021, History is a Room, Mantis Editores, Mexico in 2021, Mad Woman, Alice James Books, U.S. in 2017, and People Tree Press in the United Kingdom. The Face of Water, New and Selected Poems, People Tree Press, United Kingdom, 2011. The Strange Land, Alice James Books, U.S. 2011. The Song of Thieves, University of Pittsburgh Press, 2003. And The Water Between Us, University of Pittsburgh Press, in 1999. In addition to Alaska Quarterly Review, McCallum's poems and essays have appeared very widely in journals, anthologies, and textbooks throughout the U.S., Caribbean, Latin America, Europe, and Asia. Her poems have been translated into Spanish, Italian, French, Romanian, Turkish, and Dutch, and set to music by composers Marta Getalucci and Giddy Razas. Awards for McCallum's work include the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship, the Silver Musgrave Medal for Outstanding Merit in the Field of Literature from the Jamaican government, a Widder Banner Fellowship from the U.S. Library of Congress, and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Poetry. McCallum's poems, Nina McLaughlin observed in the Boston Globe, are arresting, lyrical, wrestling with colonialism, racism, and the non-Atlantic legacy of slavery. And Carrie Solano added this: "The poems also feel deeply intimate. The lyrics drive the musicality of the soul. These poems communicate about fulfillment, connection, the labor of seeking, loss and missing, and the history carried within the speaker. They are meditations on the existence of place within us, the way it is seated within, and the sea, and that it seeds us." It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Cheryl McCallum.
Thank you so much, Ron. It's really a pleasure to be here, to be part of this series. And I'm grateful as well to the Anchorage Museum and to Alaska Quarterly for sponsoring this. I'm going to jump in, just read a few poems and chat about a little bit about them, but mostly just read. I'm going to start with the poem that's forthcoming in the Alaska Quarterly Review. That is from that new book that Ron mentioned, Behold. This is a book that is centered on my relationship to visual art. It also deals a lot with my responses to particular works of art, especially by Black, American, and Caribbean artists. And this first one is an example of that. The artist is the well-known Jamaican-American sculptor, Simone Lee. And the piece I'm responding to is held at the National Gallery East. It's called Sentinel. And the title of the poem is At the National Gallery East. "You are who I've come here to see. Positioned at the entrance as if guarding it, your black body rises up in relief, sprawls your shadow across the museum's white-gray marbled floor and walls. Your form, como una guitarra, like mine, I think, before catching myself. You were forged in the sculptor's imagination as clearly other than me. Your head, a parabolic antenna, delicately balanced atop an elegant, elongated neck. Breasts so upright, they belie gravity and time. And your onyx skin shimmers night's palette. At 5 or 6, one of my daughters asked, "Tell me again who in our family is black?" And after I cataloged, she gleefully announced, "I'm like you, Mummy, black on the inside, white on the outside." Race, being a puzzle, she was self-satisfied to have solved. Until, some months later in school, her teacher taught about King and segregation, and she came home anxious again. I tried, reassuring, telling her something I knew wasn't the whole truth. That was the past. But she kept worrying her line of questioning. If we had lived in that time, who would I have had to go with, you or Daddy? What did my child know then of race? Maybe everything, I still don't. Sentinel, who here are you guarding? What are you guarding us against? One of the tropes, I suppose, I take up in this book, so I'm responding at times to specific works of visual art, as with Sentinel, the Sculptor by Simone Lee, but sometimes I'm just using the ideas of representation, of being seen, of how we're seen, how we see, and particularly the idea of the self-portrait, which so many visual artists end up producing. I'm particularly interested in that, and it recurs in this book across several points. So I think I'll just read maybe a couple of the self-portraits. Self-portrait. I am what's called Jamaica white, which is not a white Jamaican. And into that difference of syntax lies the difficulty of summing up history. When I try to speak plainly, I find myself again at the proverbial shore. As a child, I'm told I wandered our yard in Kingston, head tipped as if I was listening to the not far off sea or could cipher the wind. I talked to fowl and expected their reply. Maybe even then I was pursuing the wrong gods. I know the moon, saddled by its rotation around an all-consuming light, cannot be other than a mirror. The problem with every storytelling is that shorthand too often becomes longhand. If another grammar exists, I still can only locate it in the stilt walking egret wading through mangroves, in the air after a storm, and the slowing rain pinging on a galvanized roof. All the seconds, like horses gathering their galloping hooves into my chest. Self-portrait. At this point, I don't know what in me is Jamaican versus American, or reaching farther back, Trinidadian, Venezuelan, African, Scottish, English. You get the drift. I thought every mickle, mecca, muckle was from Kingston soil sprung, until in Edinburgh I heard it in the mouth of a Scotsman. For years I filed my grandmother's doo-doo as patois, failing to detect Trini French patois in her mongrel dialect. How do you say aluminium or Armageddon? Ah, for me, there interposes an extra syllable, an invisible I. And why should any one I matter is a fair question. Only because the alternative is worse. And since we're on the topic of the singular about this subject, she is awfully tired of being parsed to see if she's a fraud.
That was poet Shara McCallum. Alaska Quarterly Review Editor-in-Chief Ronald Spatz speaks next.
Today we are delighted to feature Doug Ramsbeck. Ramsbeck is the author of 10 collections of poetry, one collection of short stories, and a novella. His latest books are Smoke Memories, 2025 North Carolina Poetry Society, Blur, 2023 The Word Works, The Book of Years, 2021 Cloudbank Books, Under Black Leaves, University of Indianapolis Etchings Press, 2020, Distant Fires and Black Flowers, 2020 and 2018 from Louisiana State University Press, The Owl That Carries Us Away, 2018, and Original Bodies, 2016 by Southern Indiana Review Press. He is a three-time recipient of an Ohio Arts Council Individual Excellence Award. In addition to Alaska Quarterly Review, Ramsbeck's poems have also appeared widely in literary journals, including Kenyon Review, Slate, The Missouri Review, and The Sun. Ramsbeck has said this about his poetry: "I believe in the power of incantation in poetry. I like the feeling of summoning an elevated and musical language, of imagining that this isn't ordinary speech I am creating, but something buoyant. I also like in conversational poetry, poems with rhythms of real speech. The key, then, is figuring out how to have it both ways. For me, it means listening for the pounding pulse of the words as I write, a pulse that feels elevated but not strained. I speak my poems aloud as I compose, tasting them in my mouth while also feeling them in my fingertips." It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Doug Ramsbeck, who will share some of his poems with us today.
Thank you, Ron. I appreciate it, and I appreciate this opportunity to read today. I have found that one of the products of getting older is that I've become increasingly interested in writing about memory, and particularly writing about childhood, though I also do think of myself when I write primarily as a storyteller. And so when I say I'm talking about memory, I'm really comfortable with making some of it up. I find it liberating to focus not really on the literal truth of my life, but on some emotional simulacrum, a way of thinking, a sort of fictionalizing the past. And I want to start by reading a poem from my newest collection that'll be out in 2025, Smoked Memories, a poem that is entitled Gift Bones. She, our mother, loaded them in a cardboard box into the trunk of our Impala, where they rattled and shifted and complained on the long drive to Mississippi, where upon arrival at the tiny house outside Biloxi, we wielded shovels in a gelatinous July heat and reburied the bones from our three dead dogs, all loved in life, all mourned in death, beside what would later be our mother's flower garden, the graves marked with a clay dog she fashioned from a potter's wheel and fired in a kiln she had built in that new backyard, a kiln that reminded me, whenever I surveyed it from my bedroom window, of a miniature crematorium. And even after we moved back to the Midwest, we teased our mother that when she died, we would ferry her bones with us wherever we went, would place them in a cardboard box in the back of the car, would listen to that tambourine shuffle as we drove, though our mother insisted she would prefer we constructed from her bones a diorama or assigned her a small cupboard as an ossuary or whittled those bones into knitting needles or chopsticks or daggers or back scratchers or merely used them as cudgels, though in the end she was placed in a full-sized crematorium, and we scattered her ashes in the river, where they floated for a time in the current while the bones of the clouds drifted by. None of the events in this poem actually happened, though they feel to me in an odd way that they might have happened or should have happened. I'm drawn to them because in some ways they are fictionalized, but they reveal some of the aspects of what I remember about my family growing up. I do think, though, that storytelling in poetry is a very different, of course, than when you write a short story or a novel. And what I often think about when I'm writing a narrative poem is how can I make the conflict as extreme and focused as possible while the language remains as mysterious and indirect as possible. In other words, I sort of think of that contradiction as the core. You don't want to sort of moderate them and balance the two. I sort of feel like I'm trying to be extreme in both, extremely focused, but also sort of extremely wild. And my hope is to have it both ways. So here is a poem where I attempted that family anthem. Sister believes her brothers are the brackish waters of the river, are the possum face of the moon, and she believes that dusk light congeals inside their throats. Once she saw them set fire to the neighbor's cat, saw them dance around the flames, and she dreamed that night that their teeth crumbled in their mouths like stones, that the stars were kicked over and abandoned. And she believes that the years have soot-black tongues, that her brothers have soot-black tongues, and the songs they sing spill bitter salt into the world. Once she might have smothered them in their cribs, might have dropped them like anthems from windows. Once she watched them swim beneath a canker sore of sun, and she thought, let the mud waters carry them away, carry them under. And she dreamed that night that they were standing by her bed, were carefully dousing her with lighter fluid, and they said, we anoint you. And she said, stop. And they said, we baptize you. And she said, you are not my brothers. And they said, hush, hush. My method for writing a narrative poem is often to start by coming up with the title first. It's something that has some emotional content for me, but also has some mystery contained in it. So I don't actually know fully what the poem, what the title means. And I write, in other words, to discover that meaning. I start with the mystery of the title, and then I write to sort of answer that mystery. And here are three poems that I wrote that way. The first one is entitled The Midwest Gets Drunk and Sings Along to the Radio. My father, as he drove his drunk in his truck, would ride like Pentecostal snakes while a heavy hand thumped the steering wheel as he sang along to his gospel songs, and I watched the blood-red heads of the turkey vultures perching above the dead raccoons along the roadside. And sometimes my father drank and sang in our back porch while I watched the wasp getting drunk with him on the fallen apples in our yard, their tripartite bodies, small altars in the afternoon heat as they moved with languorous slowness, then flew back to their paper hives where they engaged in their communal hum. And still my father sang like God was a trap door that might suddenly open and send us tumbling down. And I woke some nights to hear him arriving home and singing as he stumbled from his truck, singing as the reverie of a distant train horn joined him. And the words he sang, it seemed, were like the paper skin after the snake itself has crawled away. The second poem that I wrote by coming up with a title first, sometimes I just wake in the middle of the night with a title in mind, and so then I'd get up in the morning and try to write to figure out what in the world that title meant, is Dream of the Ten Rivers. The boys summon vultures like bedclothes, wear them in their sleep, wear them to wade into the dark current of the night, and so their father unfolds his wings inside their dreams, and a wreckage of darkness gathers with a heatless fire. Until the brothers exist almost wholly inside wariness, inside boy smells, and they acquiesce to the dreamed hand lashing toward them, to the caress of fists, to the blood taste in the mouth. And the story they tell is of wildfire, of ten rivers, the water spreading outward like fingers on hands, rivers of numerology, or they tell the story of the blind prophet who sees only that there's no way out, that the years are wax and ghosts, where they sit with their father at the kitchen table, sit with their father on the porch, sit with our father in his truck until sitting becomes a kind of prayer, until the silence of their voices is a kind of prayer. And the vultures draw the pink entrails from the carcasses, conjure perfect strings of them, strings to tie around fingers in remembrance. And the brothers want to swim with their father in the current, to be their father in the current, and also to be the vultures with their shaved heads. And when it snows in winter, the brothers will skate the 10 rivers with sharp blades, blades that draw blood from the ice. And their father will come to them in their dreams, will crack the surface with heavy boots, will whisper comfort as he holds them fast beneath. And then the final poem that I thought about the title first is Father Beats His Sons Beneath an Unmoored Moon. And the ground is wet from the day's rain, and the boys are a covenant, and the boys listen for signs and hoot owl calls, and the brothers accept that the moon is an offering, and their father is a bear that emerged from his drunken den, and the sky says, here is the hole in my body from where the days crawl, and the earth says, here is the place from where everyone is born. And the vultures say, tomorrow we will suture the sky to make it fast. And the boys dream that night that they can see through bones of the earth, dream that the night sky is plucked out like an eye, that their father is a garment of clouds or a gathering of crows come morning, so many dark beaks. And the brothers petition the earth to make of the day something fetid and true. And the brothers lie awake and tell themselves that absence is a country, and pain another place on the road of the years, and they can lash the bones of that country into a raft and ride it across the eyehole of the sky's lake.
That was poet Doug Ramspeck. Alaska Quarterly Review Editor-in-Chief Ronald Spatz speaks next.
And now today's program featuring poet Julie Danho. Julie Danho is the author of the chapbook Six Portraits from Chapering Hole Press, and the full-length collection, Those Who Keep Arriving, winner of the 2018 Gerald Cable Book Award from Silverfish Review Press. In addition to Alaska Quarterly Review, her poems have appeared in journals such as Pleiades, Blackbird, Barrow Street, Southern Poetry Review, and New Ohio Review. And her poems have also been featured multiple times, actually, on Harrison Keeler's The Writer's Almanac, Verse Daily, and on Poetry Daily. Her poem 39th Birthday in Pink Flannel Donut Pajamas was first published in Alaska Quarterly Review. Julie has been the recipient of a fellowship award from the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts and also from the Rhode Island Foundation's McCool Johnson Fellowships. Of her poems, Denise Duhamel wrote this of Julia Danho's poetry. The glittering surfaces of her elegant poems are as fascinating as their substance. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Julie Danho.
Thank you so much, Ron. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this wonderful series and also for publishing three of my poems in Alaska Quarterly Review. It's one of my favorite magazines and such an honor to be in its pages. So I want to start out today by reading my three Alaska Quarterly Review poems, including the one that Ron mentioned about the pink flannel donut pajamas. And I think a lot of poets have this experience where you start out writing about one thing and end up writing about something you kind of completely didn't expect. And when I started this poem, it was because my mom had won these pajamas in a raffle, and I couldn't believe how silly I felt and how much I loved wearing these pajamas. And so basically that was kind of what prompted the poem, and it ended up being a poem about my grandmother. And so it might be helpful to know for the poem that Sita is Arabic for grandmother, Dida is Arabic for grandfather, and Hafla is kind of a potluck party. So this is called Lounging on the Couch on My 39th Birthday in Pink Flannel Donut Pajamas. Surely birds would love to peck at the dozens of donuts adorning my arms and legs, the glazed, the jellied, the vanilla frosted scalloped at the edge, like the worn lace tablecloth in Sita's tenement apartment, where my mother, father, sister, aunts, uncles, cousins would cram in Sundays post-church, And I beat the frosting off too. Return the bottoms to the box while Sita frowned and Jada insisted I should disfigure as many donuts as made me happy. After he died, she pulled the walls around her like an Afghan and didn't leave. Sundays, when I delivered the church bulletin to her recliner, she clasped my face in both hands, grateful. It's been decades since I sat in a pew, but I brought my mother to the last church hafla where she won these pajamas instead of what she wanted, the platter of walnut baklava. And maybe I've lived too long to be lounging in pink flannel donut pajamas, but I love how they rub against my leg like a cat's head. Love that someone spent time dreaming up improbable donuts like this one here, frosted blue-green, then cross-hatched with piped white stripes, topped with pink and red sprinkles, a sugared inner tube floating the middle. How can I be hungry? In the next room, my birthday cake sits on Sita's old table, mine since the day we emptied her apartment, and I opened dresser drawer after dresser drawer to find hundreds of crocheted dishcloths stacked as neatly as cash for a ransom. We knew she must have made them in her recliner by the window on those days none of us were there. It's almost noon, and I'm still in pajamas, waiting for my daughter and husband to march into the room and play me the birthday song they wrote, her on toy guitar, him on mandolin. I hear them practicing, and it's so sweet, my teeth ache. Sita was at once like this for you. And this next poem is, it's very, very different from the first one, but these were published as a pair in Alaska Quarterly Review, which I loved because they were just so opposite. So I write a lot about art, and I think this is the only poem in my book about an artwork that I actually saw in Providence, which is I live just outside of Providence, although in Rhode Island everything is just outside of Providence. So, but we have a really wonderful museum called the Rhode Island School of Art and Design Museum. And for a small city like Providence, it's really kind of a great thing to have this really wonderful museum. And I went one time and they had this artwork. And when I first looked at it, it looked like a sculpture on canvas. It was very textured and wiry, and it kind of came out from the frame in the middle. And so the poem is actually kind of designed to look like the artwork, and it's called the artwork is called Lot 022405 by Donald Moffett, and the poem is called A Long Time Without Touching. The card said oil on linen, but that silver was thick, fibrous, the whole surface like steel wool unwinding, its long wires puckering at the center and lifting off the canvas, thrusting toward me, inches and inches of, let's get sex out of the way, how it strains against itself, held back and held out. But this might be a fist, my arms, my eyes are riveted too. It was metal, I was magnetic. He applied the paint with a pastry bag. I had to look it up later to be convinced. How long did I stand there, waiting for something to happen, waiting for someone to notice me waiting? And that pastry, I like to do a lot of research on when I'm writing art poems, because I'm always so fascinated by what went into the artwork, who the artist was, and that was one of the things I learned was like that he did put it on with a pastry bag, which I thought was really fascinating. And so this next poem is a poem I wrote about nuclear war. I had read an article on CNN. It was several years ago, saying that nuclear war could break out at any moment. And I was just on my way to take my daughter to math club. So this is called CNN Says Nuclear War Could Break Out at Any Moment. CNN says nuclear war could break out at any moment, but I'm taking my daughter to math club because she loves playing money bags and some swamp and smath, which is just Scrabble looted and repackaged for math fans. Bombs are math too, half-lives and chain reactions. Decades ago, my mother was drilled to duck under her desk, protect her face and neck, But do I tell my daughter to take cover or flee for better shelter? A scientist could reduce the decision to equations lovely as calligraphy until the translation, fallout dose, transit time. Her bomb may be smaller than the one my mother waited for. A mile beyond its blast, she might survive. As she leaves the car, I hand her a backpack filled with stickers and glitter markers. We have it easier than so many. It's raining, and her umbrella springs into a bunny, its ears up, alert. And when Ron and I were talking before the recording started, I was saying that I feel like one of the major themes of my work is anxiety, and I feel like parental anxiety as evidence in that poem and in this one too. A few years ago, we took my daughter to Washington, D.C. She was about 7 or 8, I think. And I had lived in D.C. years ago when I was in college. I was an intern during the Clinton impeachment trial, although I wasn't an intern at the White House. But and things have changed so much security wise. Back then, you could just walk into museums. There was no security. There was no I don't think there were very many, if any, bollards. And bollards are the big steel poles that they put in front of the building so people can't run their cars into them. And they were her favorite thing in DC. So this is called Ode to the Security Bollards of Constitution Avenue. And it starts with an epigraph from Metro Connection News Magazine. Each bollard is a highly engineered piece of steel meant to withstand an 8-ton truck barreling at it at 50 miles an hour. My daughter runs up like you are soldiers returning from war, flinging her arms around your poles, swinging down your single file, head thrown back to the sky, inciting others to drop their parents' hands and follow her lead. We drove 400 miles so she could tour the halls of the Capitol, climb the steps of Lincoln's temple. Yet it's you she loves best. All along the mall, she finds your variations in silver and copper, even preening in green Greek columns with a congressional seal, and never questions why it is you're here. When I lived in this city, I'd visit Rockets and Pollux without emptying the metal from my pockets, but that was years before she was even an idea, before they planted you in neat rows around everything worth ruining. Now my child treats you like her playground, and I keep quiet about what you're waiting for, how deep you're driven into the ground.
That was poet Julie Danho. These selections were taken from Alaska Quarterly Review's online video series, Pièces de Résistance, found on their YouTube page. Thanks for joining us today for Addressing Alaskans. You can find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ammon Swenson. Thanks for listening.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.